Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Hello, thanks for joining us today for our Pediatric Insight conversation with the Child Health Advisory Council. My name is Bob Sawin. I'm a former Surgeon in Chief at Seattle Children's and joined by colleagues who've had major leadership roles in academic pediatric medicine and executive leaders of career physicians. And our conversation today is about the challenges of being a leader and when one is confronted with colleagues, faculty members who are outliers. I suppose we should define the term outlier because it certainly runs a spectrum. There are some people who are good, disruptive innovators, and they are by definition outliers, and they can bring a lot to an institution. But there are others who are an anchor on an institution because of their behavior or their poor performance, or people who might be struggling mid-career or frankly at any point in their career for reasons outside of work. And so it's one of our great challenges, I think, as leaders, of how to identify these people and how to guide them in course correction, and occasionally how to even help people find another career path. So I wanted to start today with the front end, if you will. How do you identify, what are some of the ways to make sure you have your finger on the pulse and you can identify faculty members who might be struggling to perform their duty or who are potentially compromising the direction or the mission of your department or your institution? Dr. Strauss, I wondered if you had, I'm sure you've had experience with that. I wonder if you had some thoughts you could share with us.
Yes, unfortunately, I have had some experience with some of these issues. I think first I would recommend that leaders make sure that they have processes and mechanisms in place to be able to find people who are struggling. So that is formal mechanisms like an evaluation process, annual at least, so that productivity, which requires answers about productivity, paper publications, grant securement, work RVUs, so measures that allow one to evaluate in an objective fashion how a faculty member is doing. And having those mechanisms in place makes it much easier to find those faculty members who may be struggling early and when they can be helped to be useful. One of those mechanisms I just mentioned, which is an annual report, which I find painful because I had to go through many of them as chair. But if they're well constructed, allow evaluation of progress. And I think that's crucial. It also is a mechanism by which, whether or not a faculty member is struggling, advice can be given about the future and what the expectations are, for example, for the next year. And if there are some concerns about productivity, that warnings or suggestions can be made prospectively. One mechanism that we found extremely useful when I was at Vanderbilt was complaints. So there was an official mechanism in place for patients to register complaints, but also for faculty and staff to register complaints. It can be difficult because of anonymity, but there was a very strong correlation with the number of complaints and when they were evaluated objectively for severity and in-depth issues to find people who were struggling. And it also provided, therefore, a mechanism for those faculty members to be remediated, for their behavior to be remediated. So I would suggest those two mechanisms, an annual evaluation and a formal complaint process, as ways to identify early those faculty members who are struggling.
Thanks, Arnie. I wonder if you or any of the other panelists had any thoughts about regular use of 360 surveys. I know they're often used for leaders, and I had had experience with using them for people where concerns have been raised. But I know some institutions build that into their biannual review process. Any thoughts or experience from panel members on using 360 tools?
I would just comment, I find them both positive and negative. Positive because they allow input, negative because often that input is not objective. I think, as with all types of evaluation, there needs to be some sorting the input from them.
Craig.
Yeah, I would say that 360s is a routine course. I haven't seen that used all that often, but I have seen, and I think it's really important to have some objective criteria of feedback from maybe patient satisfaction, mm-hmm. patient quality data, and other data that is really objective and can establish trend lines that you have discussions with that faculty member periodically if they're deviating from what you consider to be acceptable.
Bruder, you had years as a effective department chairman. I'm sure you had your moments that were manifest by challenging faculty members.
I have several comments about the 360s. If you do 360s on a person, you're basically saying this person's a problem and you're singling them out. And depending how broad this 360 is, it draws attention to them. I only did it for all my chiefs once. It was helpful, but I said to the chiefs that if we were doing 360s on them, I would have a 360 on me before we did theirs. And then I went over what people said about me, and I learned from those 360s. I had some things I could improve on, and I gave people the information that I was working on based on their input. And then doing it for all the chiefs, good, those that were doing great jobs, those were, you know, maybe having struggles in some areas, made it much more palatable, and people accepted it so much better. And that kind of gets to the next comment, is that how we have difficult decisions, often the end result is based on how much the person trusts you, how much it will be confidential, and how much they're willing to share. In some ways, it's easier to have those discussions with people who have been in the organization a while that you have a strong relationship with. The newer folks, if they're struggling, may not know you as well. I think the concept that Arnie said was so important is trying to find dealing with things early or when they arise. And, you know, sometimes it's behavioral and sometimes it's performance in terms of what they're trying to do. And oftentimes it's their system issues that are the problem, not the individual's problem. So, you know, the old adage in giving evaluations, ask, tell, and then ask. So I always found that if someone to try and get ahead of the game early on, I started instituting 30-day and 90-day evaluations that the division heads did, and really asking specific questions about were there barriers or were they struggling or were there things that they encountered that they had not expected. And I met with all of the new faculty at 90 days after the division heads had and had signed that they had talked to the person. And the reason I did that is we lost a faculty member one time after 1 year, and she came to me and said, well, nobody fixed all these problems I had when I came. And I said, what problems? She was in a research building, and no one had ever brought anything to me, and some of them could have been fixed. And I felt terrible because this was a person that I would have loved to have had remain on our faculty. I also found the annual evaluations being very helpful. I found that when annual evaluations came, frequently people said they had very vague goals for the coming year. Oh, I'm going to write more papers, or I'm going to submit more abstracts. And I always told them that a goal without a timetable and specifics is a dream. It's not a goal. And so are you going to submit a paper? Are you going to submit a abstract? Are you going to, in the next year, not necessarily punitively, but say, you know, if you reached your goal, or, you know, asking folks why, whatever the situation is, asking for their input, and then having some data, as Arnie said, of complaints or missed clinics, or and say, you know, this has come up, and people are much more willing to deal if it isn't say, why are you not doing this? But, you know, these are some data, you know, can you explain them? And then listen and try and find out, is the clinic staff not helping? Is there some scheduling problem? Is there lack of loyalty to a former administrator, you know, administrator that was close to their predecessor, this sort of thing? And sometimes it's personal. And that's the, you know, hardest thing. You know, maybe they're having marriage problems, or a child is quite ill, or parent, and listening and then trying to talk to them about possible remedies and ask their input, how you can help them out.
That's great. And actually is a good segue to, so you've accumulated this wealth of experience, and I know from personal experience that you were very good at it. The question is, how do you teach that skill to your new leaders in your department? Say your new division chief who's never been a chief before. Because I found when I was in that circumstance of having to have those difficult conversations with a faculty member that I was ill prepared for, because you recruit people because of their talents and their abilities, and you have this sort of assumption that they're going to do all the things that you expect of them. When they don't, it leads to what can be very difficult conversations. And any ideas as to how to prepare a young leader to have those tough conversations?
I think that as a leader, we have lots of opportunities to model the behavior that we want to see from our faculty members. And I would use faculty meetings actually as opportunities to do annual reviews, not a lot, but on someone who obviously was performing well, but to give them an idea of what I expected the division leaders to be doing with their individual faculty members. And I also tried to use the discussions that I would interview my division chiefs on an annual basis and sort of go through the process with them that I expected them to be going through with their faculty members. And I think that we oftentimes as leaders fail to take advantage of the sort of bully pulpit that we have to model the type of behavior that we would like to see from those young leaders that we brought in and are helping to grow and develop.
Thank you. Danielle, you had some thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's interesting when you posed the question the way you did is when you have an individual who's struggling, that individual is in the context of a larger team, and understanding team function or how we model constructive conversations may be important in addition to the direct conversation, which I think will be the next question. But it brought me to something that I did when I was chair of the Children's Hospital at Maimonides, which was to have the vice chair actually be in charge of case reviews. You know, and it was not only morbidity, mortality reviews, it was comprehensive reviews of how things happen. And he would start off with the following statement that I actually loved. We are not here to adjudicate the case. And we invited all team members. And while everyone spoke to what happened, it really did allow folks to talk to each other and how their behaviors or their clinical assessment, or even if there was a review of a bad outcome, how that conversation could be constructive and build team function. So anyway, that was what came to mind when you mentioned that. And it's a good model for frank conversations that are never hurtful, although may illuminate some real gaps in how we work as a team or our individual sort of responses.
Thank you, Danielle. You know, one of the things I think I struggled with personally when having these difficult conversations, not the detection of the problem part, but the problem has arisen or become increasingly evident, was how to have that conversation in a way that clearly sets expectations, clearly intended to course correct, and yet is viewed as supportive by the faculty member. Because we've all, I'm sure, had situations where faculty go around, geez, I got called under the carpet for or onto the carpet by so-and-so and discussion about whether the chair is being supportive in that kind of situation. Any thoughts or experience, people, things you can say, the way you can deliver that message? Danielle?
Now, I think there are a number of things we're touched upon. Having clear expectations is important so that you're not starting sort of in a nebulous way, but you understand. And one of the things that in clear expectation, I've used individual academic plans that were drafted by the faculty themselves to actually sort of map out their performance in the areas that we determine. And it's the usual ones. It's going to be clinical, educational, research, advocacy, if that was there, or policy, whatever the area. And then to map that out discreetly and direct mentorship and assigning mentors, not assigning, but having people decide on who's your career mentor, who's there. So I think those difficult conversations, when you've had clear expectations, can help. And they should be fair. They should engender trust. And I remember you made me think of a young faculty member that I actually did ask to leave. But the conversation, you know what she said to me? She took a deep breath and she said, "Oh, well, finally somebody spoke to me directly. And this is the right next step for me." Now, that doesn't always happen. But I think acknowledging that we're all human and that there are career goals, but there are also someone may be in crisis. How do you provide that support so that they can go on to whatever the next stage is? Right.
Shortly after I arrived at Seattle, there was a mid-career individual who was the associate director of a multi-center grant, who, when the PI left, was not appointed as a PI and was just furious. Very quickly, I learned it had been very disruptive. And so I sat down and talked to happened to be him, ask, you know, why he thought he was being discriminated against. And I thought, well, I asked him why he thought he wasn't appointed as a PI. And then I said, well, do you suppose it's because you really had a recent history of having really disruptive challenges that that your division head and I've had to deal with and this. And, you know, do you think that could have played a role? And he stopped and like Danielle said, he said, "I'm 45 years old and no one's really ever pointed out that I have a problem in this area." Mm-hmm. And so we talked about possible solutions. It turned out in this case, he was not very interested in changing his behavior and left. So that didn't work, but that served him well. And he's still in academics and never really achieved what he was capable of. To answer your question specifically, I had a mentor tell me in my early leadership roles that it's really important to document conversations and to do it in as positive a way as possible. So if you have a difficult conversation and you've arrived at a decision on how to proceed, to write a letter, and I would do this, saying, "I appreciate your coming and talking to me about a issue," and do it in general terms and say, "I'm glad that we were, if you were able to come to a opportunity to address this issue. And this is what we agreed upon planning, we're doing. And we've agreed to meet in a month or 2 months or whatever. This is the intervention, whatever it is, that we're planning to, that you, we've agreed on, and we're going to meet," and then send them a letter and say, "You know, if I've missed something, please let me know and we will schedule a meeting." So it gives them a chance to reply, but it also is very clear that you're there to, you know, you want to help them and you're looking forward to working with them to allow them to be successful. So I think that's an important aspect that we haven't talked about is, you know, we're talking about performance. You know, if there's something that's a very serious HR situation or something like that, that's a different situation, which you have to bring in additional people and be very specific about following the rules of your organization. But we're talking about a clinic problem or bad teaching scores or things like that.
You know, you touched on a couple of things that I wanted to emphasize about that conversation and also advocate for young leaders to read the book Crucial Conversations, which I know some might view as cliched, but I honestly think that the skills outlined in that book are essential when having these sorts of conversations. And they emphasize some of the points Bruder just made. And another book that I encourage young leaders to read is called The Coaching Habits by Michael Stanier, I think it is, who talks about leading using the techniques of coaching, basically being asking lots of questions, getting the input from the person with whom you're speaking, not being, as you said earlier, telling them, but asking and following up with more questions and getting, it makes the person feel heard, it makes the person feel supported, and it gives them a sense of ownership because they identified, you know, what the barriers are and what they can do about it. So Bruder, I think those are some really important points you made. Danielle, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, one other thought that comes to mind, I really appreciated Bruder's comments as well. And you mentioned the word both coaching and yes, crucial conversations. A couple of thoughts about that. One is that the institution needs to model crucial conversations and not just talk about it from the book. So that's important. But the other is, you know, in academic medicine, we are so hard on ourselves and on each other that I'm thinking back to a faculty member who deemed that his NIH application for, I think it was a K, did not score well initially. And he deemed that a failure. And I think one of the things is to place the context that a failure is not a failure, meaning it's an opportunity to then recruit others and to really get supported. And that a basic science lab would tell you that how many times you have to do the experiment and fail before you actually get, and I'm not sure we've done that sufficiently. Not only certain clearly identify expectations, but say built into those expectations is an expectation of failure that is used to move forward. And I'm thinking of him with some sadness, this faculty member, because it also dovetails into that person's own view of themselves. And although we say it's career oriented, it actually affects the personal, because so much of our lives and our time is devoted to medicine. It's our life, it's our life's work. I think establishing what success is means also this, the person is there. The person survives that failure, even if they have to move on. So that's what came to mind, wellness. And, you know, I know we're not delving into this today, but, you know, there is a high rate of suicide among physicians. And so how do we incorporate coaching, direct mentorship, fairness, lack of discrimination, which Bruder talked about, clear expectations, but at the end of the day, that person's okay. Okay, that person's okay. That's what came to mind.
Thank you. Those are all really, really important. Obviously, I have a bias since I'm now doing some executive coaching. But one of the barriers, the perceived barriers to executive coaching by many institutions is its expense. But I can tell you that the return on investment, if you can do some course correction or help someone advance in their career via coaching, is well worth it. But that does segue to those hopefully rare and extremely difficult circumstances that a couple of you have touched upon. Are there individuals that just despite all your efforts, just aren't, if you will, worth further effort? And how does one reach that conclusion? Craig, as a dean, I'm sure you've seen lots and lots of situations where there were people who just weren't right or who couldn't get the help they needed. Any thoughts about your experience with that?
I think that it's really important to enter those type of situations and people who have consistently fallen below performance standards to make sure as you look back on their evaluations that there's a clear course that exists, that they really have had opportunities to express the problems that they've been having and they've been had the opportunities to turn that into a success. People all want to feel like they're doing a good job. They all want to feel successful. And if you're going to have a tough conversation and saying, well, gee, the resources just aren't going to be there anymore to support this lab that's had, you know, several years of unsupported grants and it's just not going to work out. You need to frame it in the context of you want to help that person be successful and what can happen. If indeed there's a course change that needs to happen, they need to become less involved in this particular area of their professional career, you need to be prepared to talk about some other areas they can be involved in that will help them be more successful. And I think that's a really important thing. There are situations that, in my experience, have occurred, once or twice a year in which people act out in certain ways that they really can't stay at the institution. Those are pretty sad instances. And I think that those conversations, you really need to, as a leader, you need to prepare those in your mind. And they may often be very contrite. They may often deny that something happened or that they did a particular event. And usually the course that I try and say is, well, I'm glad that you're sorry. And I hope that you don't have this type of behavior again. And there are certain type of behaviors that really don't allow you to stay at this institution anymore. Let's try and figure out what other options you might have for your career, because you don't want to leave people with no options. And really, I think at the end of the day, you want to respect the people in the sense that you'd like to be respected. But on the other hand, you want to give them the message that's clear that they can't, in very unusual instances, can't stay at that institution anymore.
This has been a good conversation about, for me, one of the greatest challenges of leadership. Appreciate everybody's thoughts. It seems that there was a lot of emphasis on trying to proactively identify when people might be wobbling a little bit before they get to a full-blown struggle, and having built-in systems in place with periodicity. Bruder emphasized, for example, the importance of those early identification, early in someone's tenure at an institution. There also seemed to be a lot of awareness from all of us who've had the experience of these difficult conversations about ways that you can remain supportive of the faculty member, helping them identify their challenges and their proposed solutions, and then finding ways to hold them accountable. And above all, being respectful and supportive of the faculty, as even in those rare situations where someone has to change their role or even leave the institution, doing what we can to help them be successful in the next stage of their career. So I really appreciate everybody's input today. And if you have interest in these sorts of topics, please check out our website, where we have lots of pediatric insights about some of these challenges of leadership in academic medicine. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives, recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30 plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. Our council members include the following physicians: Bruder Stapleton, Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocque Arena, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sawin, and Arnold Strauss. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.